Anyhow, the books. Are you seeing the books? Everything you would want to read is right here. Feel it. Feels good, right? Now smell it. Nothing smells like that.
I'm sorry, excuse me. Did I just see you smell that book?
Dear Reader, a Jane Eyre podcast brought to you by the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Episode number one, the OG Jane Eyre. Greetings and salutations to the inaugural episode of Dear Reader, a limited series looking at the classic Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte through the lens of its varied and various interpretations. Of course, before I can look at those interpretations, I have to look at the source material itself, and that is what this episode is about. There won't be any continuity for this entire podcast, but I think this is definitely the jumping on point, and then you can just hop around to the various episodes depending on what medium or title interests you. I'm sure everyone's going to be super excited for the erotica episode. This episode in particular is the hardest one almost, because I have to succinctly explain why I love Jane Eyre and provide an analysis and a jumping on point for people to understand why this podcast even exists and why I think that you should give Jane Eyre a try. So here we are. It's also a bit of an organizational nightmare because I kind of just want to word vomit all over this podcast and blab about why I think Jane Eyre is such a great literary achievement, why it is my number one novel, why Jane as a character is my number one heroine in literature, but I've got to tamp it down. So hopefully you can tell how excited I am. I first wanted to actually say why I'm even doing this show. Where did this come about? And I had forgotten at one point because somebody asked, how did you come up with that idea? And I thought, oh my gosh, I don't remember. But then it did come back to me how this all came about. And it was because Amazon sends out emails and there's Prime Reading or Prime Listening or Prime Watching that you can, as a Prime member, of course, do for free. And I don't think I had been getting the Prime Reading emails, but my mother sure did, and she forwarded one to me, and there was this book called Mrs. Rochester's Ghost, which was an alternate take, of course, on Jane Eyre. And I will be actually covering that in a future episode. So, of course, I must pay due respect to it. Whether it's good or not, I have yet to read it. But I was thinking as I got this, I ended up getting it for free because I thought, well, if I get it and it's terrible, then I will have paid money for it. But because it was Prime Reading and I'm a Prime member, I was able to get it for free for Kindle. But I think at night, just thinking about the various interpretations of Jane Eyre, and wouldn't that be interesting to look at a few of them, you know, or potentially all of them? Naive Stella of a few months ago. And I went online, and let me tell you, boy, was I shocked, because Jane Eyre interpretations or adaptations has its own Wikipedia entry, because that is how many different adaptations or homages are paid to, or again, interpretations of it appear. And so that was a check for sure that, hey, I am not going to cover all of them. But then it was an interesting thought experiment of which ones would be interesting and engaging to tackle. Which ones could I take and actually pair up with one another that might contrast one another or compare really well or juxtapose really well? And so I think I've come up with a good allotment and a good spectrum of interpretations that people may be aware of or may not be aware of. Some of them, like the erotica that I mentioned, I was certainly not aware of. So I'm looking forward to this. Many of the things that I will cover, I've already seen or experienced before, and some of them I'm going to be experiencing for the first time along with listeners. So I think that's going to be a fun ride as well. And honestly, I just love Jane Eyre, and I will talk about Jane Eyre with anyone and everyone, even if that person, I mean, it's harder to speak to somebody if they don't care for it because you're just talking to a wall, basically. I think people very much dig their heels in when it comes to certain novels. I think Jane Eyre is one of them. And so I can just go on and on about why I love it and why I think it does have merit and value, but they'll be like, hey, that's great, but I don't think the same way that you do. So why, I mean, might as well get into it, right? Why do I love Jane Eyre? I think first and foremost, it's Jane herself. I tend towards, or I really find engaging, heroines, literary heroines, even film or TV heroines that I can relate to or at least find engaging, and I want to see their journey. And Jane is, for me, someone that I can absolutely relate to, even though it's in the past. I love how strong she is. I don't really like wishy-washy heroines that we sometimes see in some YA novels or just other, you know, novels, period. And it was someone who, while she loves love, and love is certainly what she sees as the purpose of living, or, you know, that we are meant to find love, she's not defined by the men in her life, that if need be, she can be single and alone, though she still wants to be surrounded by love. The love doesn't always need to be an erotic type of love. It could certainly be platonic or agape love, something which is what we see with the Rivers family for sure. And I love how she interacts with Mr. Rochester, because he can sometimes be a bit of a bully. He's a curmudgeon, a gruñón in Espanol, and she doesn't put up with it. I mean, she definitely, I could totally see her rolling her eyes constantly, but she gives as good as she gets, and she's an intelligent person. She's also loving towards Adele and other people, and I think even though her beauty or her social status may make her inferior, you know, quote unquote, to other people, I think she is far superior to many just with her heart and her actions and things that she does in throughout the novel, and sticking to her beliefs. And again, you know, she could have had many moments of weakness, in particular staying with Mr. Rochester when he said that he couldn't. I'm spoiling a bit. But staying with Mr. Rochester when he said that, well, there was an impediment to the marriage, but hey, stay with me. And boy, she could have, because she loved him, but she's like, no, that's not, it's not right for me. And also, you know, there's some obvious connection to God and religion too that I will get into, albeit briefly. But so I think first and foremost, that is a reason why I love Jane Eyre, is because of Jane herself. It'd be hard to, I think, like the novel that is titled by its character or entitled because of its character, if you didn't like the lead character, that would be problematic. I also love the genre itself, and I don't know if Jane is the one that did this, Charlotte Bronte, I guess I should say, But gothic romance, I love that genre, especially when it takes place in this particular time. I love my favorite Austen, which I think is not the standard favorite for many people, is Northanger Abbey. I love that. I love Rebecca. Just this eerie, creepy quality. Sometimes the heroines feel like there's something amiss, but it's really not. It's almost all in their head, which is certainly what Austen plays upon, because that's satirical, playing upon that particular genre. Heroines getting in, you know, over their head to a certain extent, and then you have that romantic aspect. And anyone who's listening to this who doesn't know who I am a huge shipper, so I love relationships and pairing people together, as long as it makes sense. I'm not one of those crazy people that pair people together that it's wackadoodle. But yeah, so the romance aspect is certainly something that I love about this as well. And then just, yeah, the eerie, almost noir quality of the novel. And that's carried on. So whenever I get to experience, like, The Mysteries of Udolpho, whenever I get to experience other gothic romances, I very much enjoy it. And then, you know, finally, there's probably way more that I could talk about, but just like the three big things or the three big reasons why I love Jane Eyre. The beauty of the language. I think it's one of the, I'll say more beautiful, not most beautiful, but more beautiful works of literature that I have read, and just how engaging it is. And also sometimes the language is troubling, and I think that's one of the strengths of Bronte's writing, is that it creates this eerie tone that really lends itself to this particular genre. But I've got a couple passages, so a beautiful passage, and then just a really powerful passage, and then a crazy metaphor. It might actually be a simile once I get to it, but just like three different aspects of her writing, and just, I don't know, how engaging it is, how shocking it is to a certain extent, like, oh wow, that actually works. So just three passages here. So this first one is chapter 23, and she's just explaining, basically just gives a little setting. So this is a nice little paragraph here. A splendid midsummer shone over England. Skies so pure, sun so radiant, as were then seen in long succession, seldom favor, even singly, our wave-girt land. It was as if a band of Italian days had come from the south, like a flock of glorious passenger birds, and lighted to rest them on the cliffs of Albion. The hay was all got in, the fields round Thornfield were green and shorn, the roads white and baked. The trees were in their dark prime, hedge and wood, full-leaved and deeply tinted, contrasted well with the sunny hue of the cleared meadows between. And then a key passage you guys, I think, will well, anyone, even if you haven't read Jane Eyre, I think probably you will know this. But this is chapter 23, and this is during the proposal scene. This is like the pre-proposal litter. It's a bit crazy. I tell you I must go, I retorted, roused to something like passion. Do you think I can stay to become nothing to you? Do you think I am an automaton, a machine without feelings, and can bear to have my morsel of bread snatched from my lips and my drop of living water dashed from my cup? Do you think, because I am poor, obscure, plain and little, I am soulless and heartless? You think wrong. I have as much soul as you, and full as much heart. And if God had gifted me with some beauty and much wealth, I should have made it as hard for you to leave me as it is now for me to leave you. I am not talking to you now through the medium of custom, conventionalities, nor even of mortal flesh. It is my spirit that addresses your spirit, just as if both have passed through the grave and we stood at God's feet, equal as we are. And then the third one, which was striking to me in this read-through, I've read it several times, I would say 4 to 5 times, but this one I really remembered. Oh, here it is. So this is chapter 36, and she has just returned from Moor House, and she's basically cresting a hill to see Thornfield, and this is that reaction. And of course, I think potentially I talk about this, but something that is striking about this novel as a whole, which I think I'll mention again, is that Jane speaks to the readers. So it's more personal than just first person, but she actually speaks to us. So she says here, H-E-A-R, here, an illustration reader, a lover finds his mistress asleep on a mossy bank. He wishes to catch a glimpse of her fair face without waking her. He steals softly over the grass, careful to make no sound. He pauses. Fancying she has stirred, he withdraws. Not for worlds would he be seen. All is still. He again advances. He bends above her. A light veil rests on her features. He lifts it, bends lower. Now his eyes anticipate the vision of beauty, warm and blooming and lovely in rest. How hurried was their first glance, but how they fix, how he starts, how he suddenly and vehemently clasps in both arms the form he dared not a moment since touch with his finger, how he calls aloud a name and drops his burden and gazes on it wildly. He thus grasps and cries and gazes because he no longer fears to waken by any sound he can utter, by any movement he can make. He thought his love slept sweetly. He finds she is stone dead. I looked with timorous joy towards a stately house. I saw a blackened ruin. Felt like this time that I was reading, I don't know why this time above all other times, that really was impactful for me, just having that metaphor and how a lover thinking that he's going to be almost reunited with his love or spy her beauty without her knowing. So that's Jane looking upon Thornfield and shock that instead finds her dead, and that's what Jane finds. And so just that, it's really interesting, that comparison, and again getting to the heart of Jane and her desire for love and how powerful love is in her life. So why does Jane Eyre endure? I think that's certainly something I wanted to talk about. And I also want to mention why some people don't like it, why I think they don't like it. And then I did ask some people, and I'll pull up a Google Forms and inform you what the masses say about Jane Eyre. First of all, it's emotional power and its strong female voice. That helps it endure. It's descriptions, it's vivid descriptions which craft mood. And I gave you a positive one, something that crafted beauty, that there's nothing suspicious there or dark and foreboding. And then I gave you one that does have that foreboding nature. We have depictions of obstacles that females faced in a male-dominated society, which at that time is unheard of to get that perspective. Now, right, we clamor for it and we get it. But back then, definitely not. Jane, period, I would say, it endures because of Jane. She is an every woman. She is, I think, not positively called plain Jane, but for me, I do think of it positively because oftentimes you read these novels, like I even think of Catherine from Wuthering Heights, or, you know, Lizzie Bennet definitely, I think, had beauty to her and many of Austen's. But Jane here, I think, is someone that, in my opinion, you know, I'm a plain Jane as well. And so someone that I can look to, like this is a woman who is secure in herself. Mostly we do see some insecurities that pop up, but also look at all the other stuff that she has going. So it's certainly something that is encouraging, that you may not have the looks, but what else do you have? And I think those other things that she has are way more important compared to Miss Ingram, who is really lovely outside, but inside, well, I'm afraid that she's a gold digger, and she's not kind, you know, in all, in the interactions that she has with other people, and then also the stories she tells. So clearly how she has behaved towards other people that she speaks openly about. Jane speaks to the audience, which I said before, so it is first person, but that creates an intimacy that she is speaking to us as if we've got someone there talking to us and giving her life story. And there are a few people, fictional people, that I almost imagine would be like my best friend if they were real. Barbara Gordon is certainly one of those people that I could definitely see hanging out with. And Jane is another person that I would just love to have her company and listen to her story. And this gives me an opportunity to do that. She wanders from home. She leaves home. And this is similar, of course, to a male protagonist, which I think gives some interest to this particular novel. Most females most female leads, I should say, are just relegated to home until marriage. So she really breaks that mold. So she's breaking out. She's a completely different character. She makes decisions for herself, mostly what affects herself. She considers other people, especially if we think about Mr. Rochester. I think she did want to prevent him potentially from sinning further by having her as a mistress. Jane makes decisions for herself, and she considers what could affect her or how could her character be hindered depending on what decision she makes. And these are not socially driven necessarily. I think there are morals and ethics that are also attached to them. So I think that is different, whereas many female leads of that time would have an eye to, well, romance and wealth and social status. And that's not necessarily what drives her. There's no coquetry with Jane. She's blunt. She says what she means, but not unkindly, because I think Emma has that potentially. She has a flaw, so she's not perfect. I think pride is certainly her flaw, which is interesting given how she seems to act humbly, and other people comment on that as well, but she does bristle when certain things are brought up, like her drawings. Especially, I would say, it's a bit of a hindrance when she gets her new vocation, quote unquote, when she's with the Rivers, and just these students are not up to snuff. The standard of living in that particular area is not necessarily what she was looking forward to. So there's pride there. So I do appreciate that she has a flaw, but it's something that she inwardly recognizes, so she doesn't just go on without noticing it. And it's not hubris, but it's definitely pride. Family is so important to her. It's more important to her than social standing. And I do wonder what her thoughts are, or other thoughts are, on social standing, if we could peel back the curtain and go inside and see what she thinks. But just the fact that she gets that inheritance, and I'm sorry, I'm going through a bunch of stuff, and I will go through a synopsis and everything, but just looking again, why does this endure? But just social standing and money and economy and all that stuff is really important to people of this time. And for her, it was not. It was a means, I suppose, to some sort of end. She gets that money from her uncle and she divides it up. She can bring back her cousins, which she finds out are her cousins. And then also she's able to finally, in her mind, be equal to Rochester as well and take care of herself. So she doesn't need his money, which always seemed to be a sticky area between the two of them. He was trying to force all of these things on her and she didn't really want it. I think when it comes down to it, the reason why this endures is that Jane creates her own mold of a literary heroine. And it's just so completely different from what we have seen. And I think it reaches people. It speaks to, again, what females were going through at the time, and it seems so authentic because it actually is. And so I think that's one of the reasons, besides, of course, the language and everything. Jane herself is definitely the one who makes it endure. So I asked why people don't like it. I know that, like Latin, people seem to have extremes with Jane Eyre. They either love it or they hate it. And I, of course, love it. So what were these pollers? So I had done an episode with my good friend Tom Panarese over at Required Reading with Tom and Stella. It was episode 13. And I kind of got a sense of maybe why, generally, people don't like it. And even in talking with people communally over lunch or something like that, I got a sense of why they may not. First of all, it's a long novel. And a lot of people, I think they like to keep between 200, maybe I should go lower than that, maybe 150 to 300 or 400 for their novels. And we're talking, Jane's pushing 600. And unfortunately, you know, we as, I guess I'll say Americans, we as entitled Americans seem to have ADD when it comes to doing hard things sometimes and not wanting to sit down and make it through. We don't have a lot of grit. So I think that might be potentially what we have. We just need to train ourselves, I think, or retrain, really. We've got out of it. Retrain ourselves to sitting down and going through works like this. I will admit, reason number two, I will admit that not a lot actually happens. In those 600 pages, it is a lot of, again, the beautiful language, but it is a lot of descriptions. It takes a long time for the proposal to happen, and then she leaves, and it's a long time with the rivers, and you're waiting for her to come back. So I totally get that. I could make a little timeline and have very specific moments of her journey, which I'll talk about later in this episode, but there's a lot of stuff in between, and so I totally get why that may turn people off. That's why some people don't like Dickens. I don't necessarily care for Dickens as much either. There, David Copperfield I really like, and Oliver Twist wasn't too bad either, but sometimes it's a lot. It's a lot of prose and not a lot of action that's happening. Some people do not like Mr. Rochester. Is he abusive? Is the relationship that he is in with Jane, is that toxic? Which is something that I hope to get answered in the second part of this episode. But if you can't get on board with the lead character's love interest, that's problematic. And then, of course, we have a bunch of, as my good friend Tom likes to say, sexually repressed white people. I can't remember if he says like white English people or English people, but I'm pretty sure sexually repressed white people, and you just kind of roll your eyes at all the shenanigans that they're getting into. And it is, I mean, it's a time apart from ours to go back and potentially empathetically, right, and think about what life was like for them and really put yourselves in your shoes is a bit difficult. And so I get why some people may not want to do that. So three people responded to my question of why don't you like Jane Eyre? Response number one, I think Rochester is extremely frustrating and don't really get why Jane falls in love with him. I do like the 2006 miniseries, but think they substantially altered Rochester to make him more appealing. And I believe that's the one with Toby Stevens and, oh, that woman, now I can't remember her name, who is the mother on... Oh, The Golden Compass. I can't remember her name. I had a problem with that miniseries. I remember watching it because there's like this really sexy scene. And I thought, please don't put Jane in this situation. Tom, I know, responded. He said, oh, I go into great detail about it on episode 13 of Required Reading with Thomas Dell. Yeah, he sure didn't like Jane Eyre. And I will say that that was definitely a revenge book. I don't know if it was my first revenge book, but 13 was earlier than I thought it was. But he picked Call of the Wild, and I had to get him back for that. And the third and final response, I'm conflicted about Jane. She's an important literary character because she has an actual sense of self. She has a consciousness about her personhood in a way most novelists hadn't yet characterized their protagonists. But the Rochester relationship really bothers me. And maybe I'm too stuck in my own cultural moment, but it feels like the reuniting at the end is someone going back to her emotional abuser. He has to become physically maimed for them to meet as equals. It just doesn't sit well with me. But I'm actually in the middle of a reread, so maybe this time it will strike me differently. And other people had responded, at least via Twitter, that they may not have liked the genre, a bit too dark in tone. They may not... Well, one person in particular said that Jane is not Tess of the D'Urbervilles. We all know who that was, or who responded that way. So, a variety of reasons. And as with all things, everyone is entitled to their opinions. I think in particular with this read-through that I just did in order to start this episode, I took my time, especially I think with the men. So as I have been reading it, I feel like the first time that I read it was actually, oh man, it was either at the end of high school or it was near the beginning of college, and it was definitely on my Rory Gilmore's reading list. And you know, as you read it at different points in your life, as you're changing, your reaction to what you're reading changes as well, which is interesting. Someone had recently asked me if I'm a rereader, and only occasionally, because there are so many books that I want to read, right? But there are ones like this that I do want to continue to come back to, but I don't like to read it every year. I know that there's some people that like to read. I think Rob Kelly likes to read The Razor's Edge every year. And I don't want to do that with Jane, if only because it's so special to me when I read it each time, that I never want that feeling to dull. But also, as I'm growing and maturing and coming into my own personhood, I start to reach out into certain passages or certain moments of the story hit me more at different points in my life. And so in this particular point, I think the men, I was really looking at and interested in the men, and potentially part of it could have been because I did want to examine Rochester's relationship to Jane or with Jane. But, you know, St. John Rivers is also not a positive, I don't care for him as much. I think there are positive things to talk about in regards to him, but he's also just such a pillar of the patriarchy in how he's dealing with Jane and how he deals with his own quote-unquote love life, even with his sisters, and just not seeming like a happy man, which is like, man, so does the patriarchy not only hammer down women, but it probably also hammers down its own men because they're not able to potentially live up to their own personhood and come into their own or have their own ideas. I don't know. There's also lots of stuff going on with religion, which I'll again get into. But yeah, I think when it's not well received, you can definitely look at the men and just compare those two. And hey, neither of them are. I can't hold Rochester up and be like, he's such a great literary hunky hunkster. No, I can't do that. I can't say that he's got loving kindness. I think there's definitely character change. His character's dynamic, and we see it, especially at the end. Yes, my anonymous responder got it right about the maiming. That, what does that say symbolically, that now they're equals potentially? Who knows? Ugh. But that's why people don't like it. And I'm not going to focus on that. So I think, golly, that's my preamble. Can you believe it? So this one, I guess this episode is going to be long. People made fun of me and said that this is going to be a 50-hour podcast. And hey, it may be. But I got to get through all this stuff. And then the other episodes will maybe be more bite-sized. But can I actually talk about Charlotte Bronte and also give a synopsis? And then I have some analysis to do with Jane, but I've talked about, I think I've already been analyzing it. And also, yeah, definitely go over to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, episode 13. I'm trying not to tread the same stuff that I've been doing. And I think there's definitely so much out there that you can do. So I'm trying to do something different. So Charlotte Bronte, this came from victorianweb.org. Charlotte was born in 1816. She's the third daughter of the Reverend Patrick Bronte and his wife Maria. And her brother Patrick Branwell was born in 1817. Her sisters Emily and Anne in 1818 and 1820. In 1820, the Bronte family moved to Haworth, and Mrs. Bronte died the following year. In 1824, the four eldest Bronte daughters were enrolled as pupils at the clergy daughter school at Cowan Bridge. The following year, Maria and Elizabeth, the two eldest daughters, became ill, left the school, and died. Charlotte and Emily, understandably, were brought home. If you haven't already guessed, those were my first two bullet points. This family has so much tragedy involved. So the fact that Charlotte can even write a somewhat uplifting or happy ending novel is extraordinary, but perhaps escapism existed even back then. Can you believe it? In 1826, Mr. Bronte brought home a box of wooden soldiers for Branwell to play with. Charlotte, Emily, Branwell, and Anne, playing with the soldiers, conceived of and began to write in great detail about an imaginary world which they called Angria. In 1831, Charlotte became a pupil at the school at Roehead, but she left the school the following year to teach her sisters at home. She returned to Roehead School in 1835 as a governess. For a time, her sister Emily attended the same school as a pupil, but became homesick and returned to Haworth and took her place from 1836 to 1837. In 1838, Charlotte left Roehead School. In 1839, she accepted a position as governess in the Sidgwick family, but left after 3 months and returned to Haworth. In 1841, she became governess in the White family, but left once again after 9 months. So the multiple times that I've said governess in her biography should give you an indication that she's writing from personal experience. Upon her return to Haworth, the three sisters, led by Charlotte, decided to open their own school after the necessary preparations had been completed. In 1842, Charlotte and Emily went to Brussels to complete their studies. After a trip home to Haworth, Charlotte returned alone to Brussels, where she remained until 1844. Upon her return home, the sisters embarked upon their project for founding a school, which proved to be an abject failure. Their advertisements did not elicit a single response from the public. The following year, Charlotte discovered Emily's poems and decided to publish a selection of the poems of all three sisters. 1846 brought the publication of their poems, written under the pseudonyms of Kerr, Ellis, and Acton Bell. Charlotte also completed The Professor, which was rejected for publication. The following year, however, Charlotte's Jane Eyre, Emily's Wuthering Heights, and Anne's Agnes Grey were all published, still under the Bell pseudonyms. In 1848, Charlotte and Anne visited their publishers in London and revealed the true identities of the Bells. In the same year, Branwell Bronte, by now an alcoholic and a drug addict, died, and Emily died shortly thereafter, and Anne died the following year. In 1849, Charlotte, visiting London, began to move in literary circles, making the acquaintance, for example, of Thackeray, which, of course, is the author of Vanity Fair. In 1850, Charlotte edited her sister's various works and met Mrs. Gaskell. In 1851, she visited the Great Exhibition in London and attended a series of lectures given by Thackeray. The Reverend A.B. Nichols, curate of Haworth since 1845, proposed marriage to Charlotte in 52. And the Reverend Mr. Bronte objected violently, and Charlotte, who, though she may have pitied him, was in any case not in love with him, and refused him. So again, we're seeing some threads here. Nichols left Haworth in the following year, the same in which Charlotte's Villette was published. By 54, however, Mr. Bronte's opposition to the proposed marriage had weakened, and Charlotte and Nichols became engaged. Nichols returned as curate at Haworth, and they were married, though it seems clear that Charlotte, though she admired him, still did not love him. So we see a thread potentially of St. John Rivers. In 54, Charlotte, expecting a child, caught pneumonia. It was an illness which could have been cured, but she seems to have seized upon it, consciously or unconsciously, as an opportunity of ending her life. And after a lengthy and painful illness, she died, probably of dehydration. So wow, what an upper to end on. I did want to give some personal context of the novel, as well as some historic context. So the early sequences in which Jane is sent to Lowood, which is this harsh boarding school, are derived from the author's own experiences. Helen Byrne's death from tuberculosis, referred to as consumption, recalls the death of Charlotte Bronte's sisters, Elizabeth and Maria, who died of the disease in childhood as a result of the conditions at their school. Mr. Brocklehurst is based on Reverend William Carus Wilson, the evangelical minister who ran the school. And additionally, John Reed's decline into alcoholism and dissolution recalls the life of Charlotte's brother Branwell, who became an opium and alcohol addict in the years preceding his death. And finally, like Jane, Charlotte became a governess, and these facts were revealed to the public in The Life of Charlotte Bronte, which was published in 1857 by Charlotte's friend and fellow novelist Elizabeth Gaskell. The Gothic manor of Thornfield Hall was probably inspired by North Lees Hall near Hatheridge in the Peak District, and this was visited by Charlotte Bronte and her friend Ellen Nussey in the summer of 45, and is described by the latter in a letter dated the 22nd of July in 1845. It was the residence of the Eyre family, and its first owner, Agnes Ashurst, was reportedly confined as a lunatic in a padded second floor room. See all this coming together? It has been suggested that the White Collar Hall in Lancashire, close to Haworth, provided the setting for Ferndean Manor, to which Mr. Rochester retreats after the fire of Thornfield. There are similarities between the owner of Ferndean, Mr. Rochester's father, and Henry Cunliffe, who inherited White Collar in the 1770s and lived there until his death in 1818. One of Cunliffe's relatives was named Elizabeth Eyre. The sequence in which Mr. Rochester's wife sets fire to the bed curtains was prepared in an August 1830 homemade publication of Bronte's The Young Man's Magazine, number 2. And finally, Charlotte Bronte began composing Jane Eyre in Manchester, and she likely envisioned Manchester Cathedral Churchyard as the burial place for Jane's parents and the birthplace of Jane herself. Some historic context, just very briefly, and this actually came from Professor Regina Bukola of Roosevelt U. Of course, we now know Charlotte used a male pseudonym, Currer Bell, so that her literature would be taken more seriously, which is ridiculous, but at that time, it makes sense. But this also shocked people because of how authentic it seemed to the female experience written by a man. Crazy. It was written in Victorian era, which means that at this time, we've got economic growth through the Industrial Revolution, we have the expansion of the British Empire, and increasing democratization. Of course, I said we, not the US, but England, UK. There are sharp class divisions. Servants who did work to keep estates in order had to show deference to employers. Governesses were treated a bit better than lower class, but still an in-between status. They're part of the family, and yet they're not part of the family. The Bible was widely read and quoted, and the village church was a central part of community life. And non-Europeans, I will get to this because it's 2020, we've got to look through this lens. Non-Europeans were viewed by, of course, Europeans and the English as having ways and beliefs inferior to those of the British. And this inspired many churchgoers to travel abroad as missionaries to convert them to Christianity. Okay, so that's the background of the author of the, I guess, England. I'm going to give a plot synopsis in case you have no idea what Jane is. I mean, I've spoiled all of these plot points, I think, in my random analysis. See how this was an organizational nightmare for me? Okay, here we go. Jane Eyre is a young orphan being raised by Mrs. Reed, her cruel, wealthy aunt. A servant named Bessie provides Jane with some of the few kindnesses she receives, telling her stories and singing songs to her. One day, as punishment for fighting with her bullying cousin John Reed, Jane's aunt imprisons Jane in the Red Room. And no, it's not Red Room. It's not that. The room, well, it could be close to it, huh? The room in which Jane's uncle Reed died. While locked in, Jane, believing that she sees her uncle's ghost, screams and faints. She wakes to find herself in the care of Bessie and the kindly apothecary, Mr. Lloyd, who suggests to Mrs. Reed that Jane be sent away to school. To Jane's delight, Mrs. Reed concurs. Once at the Lowood School, Jane finds that her life is far from idyllic. The school's headmaster is Mr. Brocklehurst, a cruel, hypocritical, and abusive man. Brocklehurst preaches a doctrine of poverty and privation to his students while using the school's funds to provide a wealthy and opulent lifestyle for his own family. Don't worry, I'll get to him. At Lowood, Jane befriends a young girl named Helen Burns, whose strong, martyr-like attitude toward the school's miseries is both helpful and displeasing to Jane. A massive typhus epidemic sweeps Lowood and Helen dies of consumption. The epidemic also results in the departure of Mr. Brocklehurst by attracting attention to the insalubrious conditions at Lowood. After a group of more sympathetic gentlemen takes Brocklehurst's place, Jane's life improves dramatically. She spends 8 more years at Lowood, 6 as a student and 2 as a teacher. After teaching for 2 years, Jane yearns for new experiences. She accepts a governess position at a manor called Thornfield, where she teaches a lively French girl named Adele. The distinguished housekeeper, Mrs. Fairfax, presides over the estate. Jane's employer at Thornfield is a dark, impassioned man named Rochester, with whom Jane finds herself falling secretly in love. She saves Rochester from a fire one night, which he claims was started by a drunken servant named Grace Poole. But because Grace Poole continues to work at Thornfield, Jane concludes that she has not been told the entire story. Jane sinks into despondency when Rochester brings home a beautiful but vicious woman named Blanche Ingram. Jane expects Rochester to propose to Blanche, but Rochester instead proposes to Jane, who accepts almost disbelievingly. The wedding day arrives, and as Jane and Mr. Rochester prepare to exchange their vows, the voice of Mr. Mason cries out that Rochester already has a wife. Mason introduces himself as the brother of that wife, a woman named Bertha. Mr. Mason testifies that Bertha, whom Rochester married when he was a young man in Jamaica, is still alive. Rochester does not deny Mason's claims, but he explains that Bertha has gone mad. He takes the wedding party back to Thornfield, where they witness the insane Bertha Mason scurrying around on all fours and growling like an animal. Rochester keeps Bertha hidden on the third story of Thornfield and pays Grace Poole to keep his wife under control. Bertha was the real cause of the mysterious fire earlier in the story. Knowing that it is impossible for her to be with Rochester, Jane flees Thornfield. And of course, he does try to convince her to stay as his mistress, but she says no. Penniless and hungry, Jane is forced to sleep outdoors and begs for food. At last, three siblings who live in a manor alternatively called Marsh End and Morehouse take her in. Their names are Mary, Diane, and St. John Rivers, and Jane quickly becomes friends with them. And if you've not read this, St. John, it looks like St. John, so just be aware of that. St. John is a clergyman, and he finds Jane a job teaching at a charity school in Morton. He surprises her one day by declaring that her uncle, John Eyre, has died and left her a large fortune, £20,000. When Jane asks how he received this news, he shocks her further by declaring that her uncle was also his uncle. Jane and the Rivers are cousins. Jane immediately decides to share her inheritance equally with all of her three newfound relatives. St. John decides to travel to India as a missionary, and he urges Jane to accompany him as his wife. Jane agrees to go to India, but refuses to marry her cousin because she does not love him. St. John pressures her to reconsider, and she nearly gives in. However, she realizes that she cannot abandon forever the man she truly loves, when one night she hears Rochester's voice calling her name over the moors. Jane immediately hurries back to Thornfield and finds that it has been burned to the ground by Bertha Mason, who lost her life in the fire. Rochester saved the servants, but lost his eyesight and one of his hands. Jane travels on to Rochester's new residence, Ferndean, where he lives with two servants named John and Mary. At Ferndean, Rochester and Jane rebuild their relationship and soon marry. Dear reader, I married him. At the end of her story, Jane writes that she has been married for 10 blissful years and that she and Rochester enjoy perfect equality in their life together. She says that after 2 years of blindness, Rochester regained sight in one eye and was able to behold their first son at his birth. I guess even though I will say Mr. Rochester isn't the most handsome of romantic heroes, if we call him a romantic hero, I think the feelings that Jane feels, I do get swept up in them as a shipper. And then at the end, just to have that relationship and equality, and he loved her for her, you know, throughout, and she loved him for him with all of his flaws and everything, that is something to aspire to for sure. And I get that there are some problems there, but I will say I think that's another reason why I love this so much. So, golly. Let me skip around. Again, remember, if you want really great analysis or questions and responses and conflict, then you should go to Required Reading, because this is just me talking about it. So just to begin, this novel is an example of a Bildungsroman, which is a German word. But Bildung has the meaning of shaping and formation, and Roman means novel. It's a novel that deals with the development of the protagonist, and it's definitely a coming-of-age book. Usually, the character learns some lessons, there's moral development, there might be some psychological development, and a child matures. I think this often happens with male leads. So again, out of the norm, we've got a female falling into this particular category. I was just thinking, you know, David Copperfield. That was probably the best one, I would say. Maybe Oliver Twist, maybe Great Expectations. I mean, all the Dickenses, basically, I think, are Bildungsroman. Some of the morals, of course, they may be dealing with right and wrong and psychologically dealing with emotions and behavior. We also have some Byronic themes here, or Byronic. It's a Byronic genre, maybe I can say, but Rochester is definitely a Byronic hero. He's got dark features, he's brooding, he's emotionally turbulent with his personality, he's got a willingness to go to the extreme, all of the above. And Byronic characters, scenes, actions, and structures, they're moody, they're mysterious, they're alluring, and usually dark. So this is definitely a Byronic as well as a Bildungsroman novel. So there's so much going on. All the bees are coming with us. It's feminist, which I love. Richard Chase actually admitted in 48, somewhat grudgingly is what my quote says, that, well, obviously Jane Eyre's a feminist tract, an argument for the social betterment of governesses and equal rights for women. Yes, absolutely. And it was shocking. It was shocking to people, not only, I think, in this feminism, probably before maybe they had the word feminism or it could be perceived, but Victorians were probably shocked in how she's a bit rebellious, right? She does have some pride. She is certainly maybe at times, quote-unquote, anti-Christian, just the fact that she, well, she does survive, but she doesn't thank God too much for her survival. And I did mention before that she makes decisions that are for her. And yes, morally, like, how is this going to affect me and everything? But she doesn't necessarily go along the lines of, also, this is, you know, wrong behavior, looking up to the big G-O-D at all times. So she does go her own path. Not only as a feminist, but also as someone who's, I think, trotting the lines between the world and Christianity. But I'll get a bit more to that when I talk briefly about religion in here. Jane is also really passionate. I think, golly, I'm going to go against many things that I have said when I discovered that erotica. But she's passionate, but I don't think, I guess it could be seen as sexual passion. But her passion, I think, is also in her responses to people. I mean, even in that section that I read to you, how passionate she is in that response, and even angry, I think, to or towards Edward. And these aren't dainty flowers, or, you know, we're used to female leads as dainty flowers, and that is not her. Again, blunt, that no coquetry. She's definitely going to say what she means, and she's going to speak out for herself as she's discovering her own personhood. Now, of course, there is another woman in this novel. I mean, there are several, but one that could be oddly compared or contrasted with Jane, and that is, in fact, Bertha. And I did read several sections of The Mad Woman in the Attic by Sandra Gilbert and Susan Guber, so I will quote from time to time about these two. But what was interesting about these two, if you pair them together, is, and if you don't know me, I am a classics major, as well as an architecture major, but we'll go with the classics for right now. I'm a classics major, so I will often bring in classical ideas. So there's definitely this classical idea within epic poetry of portrayals of women are pretty, I don't know, black and white not be the right term, but there are only two. There's really just the dutiful wife and then the sorceress, and where are you falling within there? And it does start to get opened up. But if we just take maybe Homer's Odyssey for an example, you have the Penelope archetype, and then you have someone like Calypso or Circe as the other archetype. And that's definitely, I see that here with Jane and Bertha, right? Jane being that dutiful wife, Bertha being that sorceress. But what the Mad Woman in the Attic, what they're saying, or their comparisons, is that women are often portrayed as either an angel or a monster. And that's what we have here, with Jane being the angel and Bertha being the monster. Bertha, potentially, is Jane. She is the unbridled version of Jane. I think it's a Jane that we see a glimpse of as a child, and I will call her pre-Helen Burns, PHB, the pre-Helen Burns Jane. But she grows out of it, but it's almost what Jane could be. But what's almost keeping her from becoming that? I think this novel has pro-con women. It might be feminist, but there are some criticisms against women as well. Jane seeks freedom and equality with a man, or with men in general, And that's definitely, I would say, positive. There's the positive femininity. But Bertha has the bad parts of women. She's uncontrollable. She's emotional. She's perverse. She's passionate. There's that passionate, right? Which when Jane is giving that passionate speech, people would be like, oh my gosh, keep it together. St. John Rivers constantly, I would say constant, multiple times. Let's just say constantly. Criticizing Jane that this is too passionate, you need to calm down, all that stuff. No one wants to be told to calm down. Pages 361 to 362 of Mad Woman the Attic, they say, nevertheless, it is disturbingly clear from recurrent images in the novel that Bertha not only acts for Jane, she also acts like Jane. The imprisoned Bertha running backwards and forwards on all fours in the attic, for instance, recalls not only Jane the governess, whose only relief from mental pain was to pace backwards and forwards in the third story, but also that bad animal who is 10-year-old Jane imprisoned in the red room, howling and mad. Bertha's goblin appearance, half dream, half reality, says Rochester, recalls the lover's epithets for Jane. Malicious elf, sprite, changeling, as well as his playful accusation that she had magically downed his horse at their first meeting. Rochester's description of Bertha as monster, a fearful voyage I had with such a monster in the vessel, which is chapter 27, ironically echoes Jane's own fear of being a monster. Am I a monster? Is it impossible that Mr. Rochester should have a sincere affection for me? Chapter 24. Bertha's fiendish madness recalls Mrs. Reed's remark about Jane. She talked to me once like something mad or like a fiend, as well as Jane's own estimate of her mental state. I will hold to the principles received by me when I was sane and not mad as I am now. Chapter 27. And again, the principles, right, received by me. Where do those principles come from? Do they come from God? Did you come up with your own principles? So again, coming out of that box there. And most dramatic of all, Bertha's incendiary tendencies recall Jane's early flaming rages at Lowood and at Gateshead, as well as that ridge of lighted heath, which she herself saw as emblematic of her mind in its rebellion against society. It is only fitting, therefore, that as if to balance a child, Jane's terrifying vision of herself as an alien figure in the visionary hollow of the Red Room looking glass, the adult Jane first clearly perceives her terrible double when Bertha puts on the wedding veil intended for the second Mrs. Rochester and turns to the mirror. At that moment, Jane sees the reflection of the visage and features quite distinctly in the dark oblong glass, sees them as if they were her own, and that's chapter 25. So even though it's written by a woman, and whether in consciously or subconsciously, how can you do this subconsciously? Really pushing forward and being pro-woman, you definitely have those criticisms there as well. And whether or not this is conditioning, social conditioning, that it's just always going to be there and you're always, as a woman, thinking potentially negatively of yourself and apologizing for things that you have no reason to apologize for and things like that. That's going to pop up, those negative qualities of femininity as well. But an interesting classical idea besides, the angel and the demon is certainly interesting. I'm totally on board for it. But I do like, the dutiful wife and the sorceress idea as well. And I will get back to Bertha because I do want to talk a bit more about her through the 2021 lens. I want to talk a little bit about Christianity. And I think that will be okay. I'm going to take it, just looking at how it's used in this novel, its presentation and everything. So I don't think anyone's going to become uncomfortable, but it's a huge theme. It's within the historical and personal context of not only England, but Charlotte as well. So I can't ignore it. So first of all, this novel, I think, gives us insight into Charlotte's belief system. And I feel like Charlotte may be pretty close to Jane and how she acts. And I think that there is a healthy dose of criticism of Christianity as well. I mean Christianity as the institution more so than the actual religion, because if you look at Christianity just with Christ as the, the originator of it. There's no problems with that. It's when other people get involved and then we have denominations and all of this other stuff and people, yeah, that's when we have issues. So I think there's a healthy criticism of the institution itself rather than the religion. And we have three distinct characters giving three distinct portrayals of Christianity that are alive and well today and things that you could potentially criticize, or in the case of one of them, you can't. Brocklehurst, ugh, he is one of the reasons why, actually, he's one of the main reasons why, or this type of person, why people have an issue with Christianity today, because they look at Christians and they feel like, well, you're saying da-da-da-da-da, but you're acting like this. Hypocritical. And that's exactly who Brocklehurst is. That he wants them to live humbly and with a lack of resources and things and be joyful and glad in it. And yet he is vain. Maybe not his own person, but certainly how he presents his family. And his family is living it up, lap of luxury. So definitely some hypocrisy there. And just generally not a kind-hearted or loving kindness. He doesn't have, what virtues does he have? Guess he knows the Bible. But as someone who, me personally, who I do not like people giving out of context Bible quotes, he seems to be that type of person who will just drop a Bible verse down, the drop of a hat. And if you zoom out in context, that doesn't really work. So hypocrisy and not being a good leader, not being a good church leader or Christian leader. And then on the other side, we have St. John, who is legalistic, and those, again, some criticism there. Just there's no bend, there's no grace with those people, right? And following the letter of the law, which is all well and good, but to the detriment potentially of others. And there's definitely interpretation somewhere, right? One person's interpretation isn't the only way to go. He is also, I feel like, more good works and less faith. I really tried to read him more so in this particular read. And it just seems like he's all about doing the good works. And I just feel like, I don't know, there's not a lot of joy in him in what he is doing. And it's almost like one of the quotes, right, is that we'll marry and enough of love will follow. And it's almost like I'm going to do these good works and potential, you know, that joy will follow or something like that. But oof, yeah, just really, really intense, really intense. And I think people can be like this, but, oh man, I feel like he is, you know, a quote unquote good man, but there's just something missing. It's just hard. It's hard to read. And I feel like it's got to also be hard to live that way. And then the happy medium and the best portrayal of Christianity, which I could, I mean, we definitely do need to talk about, I think, Charlotte/Jane here, but which I will talk about with St. John. The best representation is definitely Helen Burns. She is the Christ figure in the novel. It's all too briefly is she around. I wish she would have lived. I wonder what that would be like for Jane. Jane probably actually would not have met Rochester had Helen lived through all of that. I think they would have gone off together and been governesses together and just BFFs for forever. But, oh man, so good. She recognizes her flaws. She, you know, atones for them. There's a lot of grace. She tries to teach Jane, and I think she does. She is a good model of behavior. She's certainly tortured, for lack of a better word, by certain people at that institution. And she's like, yeah, you know, it had to happen. They were right. I was being slovenly. Things like that. It's just like, oh my gosh, who are you? So definitely the best portrayal. And I think Charlotte does that on purpose. And then you have Jane, which again, I think is a stand-in potentially for Charlotte. I think Jane is trying to get her footing in the world. I think there is religion for her, but she's also seen the negative aspects of it. She's seen the positive aspects with Helen, but she also sees what happens to Helen, not only in her suffering and death, but also her suffering at the hands of other people for just being good, it seems like. And then you have hypocrisy, and then you have Sinjin, who is all about abnegation and just denying his feelings. And then you have Jane, who wants love, but which is great, right? We absolutely seek that love. And I think perhaps the proper order of things, right, is to seek that love first from Christ. But she's seeking that earthly love. So you've got a bit of a chafing there, I think, of the world and Christianity in the form of Jane, which is why I think we may end with Sinjin, which is curious. I feel like I ask this question all the time. I think every time I finish the novel, I'm shocked that it ends with Sinjin Rivers. And this time I thought about it a lot. But yeah, let's see here. Golly, the last page really is all about Sinjin, you know, where he went, that he went to India and everything. And he ends up dying. Sinjin is unmarried. He will never marry now. Himself has hitherto sufficed to the toil, and the toil draws near its close. His glorious sun hastens to its setting. The last letter I received from him drew from my eyes human tears, and yet filled my heart with divine joy. He anticipated his sure reward, his incorruptible crown. And then at the very end, my master, he says, has forewarned me. Daily he announces more distinctly, surely I come quickly, and hourly I more eagerly respond, amen, even so come, Lord Jesus. Those are his own words. So, ending with Sinjin, oh my gosh, why? But I think, potentially, we may show the weakness of Jane compared to the holiness of Sinjin. Even though this novel has been trying to portray Jane so positively apart from her male counterparts, so this may not make as much sense if we're doing that. But could also be showing that those that are religiously devout can and sometimes do meet a sad fate, especially in our worldly terms. Maybe because they didn't have a balanced life. Again, many, many, many good works. His faith is there. I feel like his good works almost outshine his faith. And then he gave up on love, or he wasn't necessarily seeking that. It's almost as if he were seeking mostly, yeah, the reward that he can get from his father. Is he looking for love from his father? You know, capital F father. Is he looking for affirmation? It just seems like maybe nothing, not everything is in its right place. And with Jane ends up in a more or less happy medium. And that's not to say that we shouldn't just dispose of religion and leave it behind. But she was able to find that middle ground. Again, she keeps her morals intact. She keeps to herself. She lives authentically. And while she may not give that or give thanks to God about that, it has to come from somewhere. That virtue has to come from somewhere. And I feel like that's definitely something that is God-given, but it's something that she's kind of working through. So you've got really obvious archetypes that are negative and positive. And then you have someone, again, real life and authentic, someone you can relate to that's working through this and may or may not be 100% on board religion, but there's something there, right? So I think that's, again, just something that I very much enjoy about this particular novel as someone who sometimes does struggle with religion and Christianity and, yeah, hypocrisy that I see in the church and with people. Jane is certainly someone that, you know, you can look to like, hey, how can I be like this? Yeah, how can I straddle? Should I be straddling the line? Things like that, things I question. This time, something new that I discovered is this line. See if I can find it. It's when she comes back and he asks her, well, she's already come back, but he asks her how she knew to come back, basically. And there was that voice but she did not tell him. The coincidence struck me as too awful. He explains when he said her name, and then she realized it was the same time. So, if I told anything, my tale would be such as must necessarily make a profound impression on the mind of my hearer. And that mind, yet from its sufferings too prone to gloom, needed not the deeper shade of the supernatural. I kept these things then and ponder them in my heart. And that ponder them in my heart, I immediately thought of Mary, mother of Jesus. And that is what she says. Of course, translations will differ depending on what you're reading. But that is what she is said about her, when the angel comes down and basically tells her everything that's about to happen, you know, what, I'm a virgin. And he's like, you know, don't worry about that. We got that covered. And she ponders all of this in her, like, what does that mean? And so it's something I spent, I think, an entire week of a Bible study on that phrase, just pondered in their heart, and what does that mean? And it's just like so thoroughly considering that your soul and your heart and your mind are all wrapped up in understanding what this means. And for Mary, of course, that's a huge thing. You know, what does this mean? That I will be bearing the Son of God, that I'm a virgin, that's going to be Immaculate Conception, like all of that, that's crazy stuff that's happening to probably a 13-year-old. And here we have Jane, not very far off from Mary in terms of age, considering that she was at this more or less happy situation or contented situation. Also, that she was borderline about to change her life and go to India. And then something happened that she heard Edward call to her and come over. Like, what is that? And I think the pondering in the heart, I think that's also a great phrase because it brings some religion into there as well. Bronte says supernatural, or Jane says supernatural, which we could, some people do when I talk to them who aren't believers, they do consider, they say that they may not like Christianity or the idea of it because it is too supernatural. So you could take that. But also, like, where did that come from? How did we come together? Where was that voice come from? How did it cross miles? And could that have been God right there? She doesn't speak to that necessarily, but I think pondering in the heart is a really interesting phrase. Other religious things that I noted, or I guess the last one was really John Reed. I think the addiction, of course, is, as we saw, something that was personal to Charlotte in regards to her brother. But I also, saw similarities between John and the prodigal son parable, and just that he went off, he spent everything, but he didn't come back. So that was the one thing that didn't happen, and that was something that broke his mother's heart, and that was hard for her. And also addiction, looking at it again through this 2021 or modern lens, just addiction and how hard it is for all parties, and that she was trying to help him, but it was more enabling him, and what help really was there for addicts back then. So that was also something to consider. Okay, so I guess two more things, some classical ideas. I already talked about the dutiful wife and the sorceress. Dreams' importance are huge. The tree, the baby which pops up. What an interesting thing that when babies are involved in dreams, something bad may happen. But just dreams' importance in general are a classical idea. And oftentimes, of course, there are two gates that create dreams, false dreams and true dreams that originate down in the underworld. And some of these are fake and you shouldn't follow them, and other ones actually you probably should listen to. And it seems like all of the ones that we are told about in this narrative are ones that are significant, especially Bessie, I think, talks about a friend of hers had one about a baby, and then Jane had two different dreams right before the marriage, and they were actually pretty crucial. So then I get to the heroine's journey, and this is it besides the 2021 lens that I want to talk about briefly, but I want to look at Jane slightly differently, right? I've already been analyzing it, I think, throughout and really skipping around, but I thought, oh, what if we see if Jane Eyre's journey follows the heroine's journey? Now, the heroine's journey is somewhat based off of the hero's journey, but this is a model created by Maureen Murdoch in The Heroine's Journey, Woman's Quest for Wholeness. And she divides it into 10 stages. And so I went through and I thought, oh, does it match? Does it not match? It actually matches pretty well. There's only one that is out of sequence. So I will explain what the stage is and then tell you what happens or how it relates to the novel or vice versa. So number one, heroine separates from the feminine. The feminine is often a mother or mentor figure or a societally prescribed feminine marginalized outsider role. Specifically for Jane, we have the terrible mother model with Mrs. Reed, but not the great mother model. So Jane does not have, again, golly, everyone kills off the parents. Have you noticed that, Disney? Comic books? Golly. Anyways, she separates physically and psychologically from the terrible mother, and Jane seeks liberty. Liberty and love, freedom and love are two things that she's really seeking. Number two, identification with the masculine and gathering of allies. The heroine embraces a new way of life. This often involves choosing a path that is different than the heroine's prescribed societal role, gearing up to fight an organization, role, group that is limiting the heroine's life options, or entering some masculine/dominant identity defined sphere. Definitely Mr. Reed, I think, is the closest thing to father that she has. She has allies like occasionally Bessie, definitely Miss Temple and Helen, and then the apothecary as well. So those would be those allies that she's gathering. And the fight, I think, involves fighting the Reeds as well as Lowood, or at least trying to survive Lowood. Number three, road trials and meeting ogres and dragons. The heroine encounters trials and meets people who try to dissuade the heroine from pursuing their chosen path or who try to destroy the heroine. Definitely, we've got Brocklehurst, we've got Lowood, we have neglect and abuse until the changeover happens. Number four, experiencing the boon of success. The heroine overcomes the obstacles in their way, and this is typically where the hero's journey ends. She becomes a teacher at Lowood, and then she is looking for the governess position here. Number five, heroine awakens to feelings of spiritual aridity or death. The heroine's new way of life, attempting the masculine dominant identity, is too limited. Their success in this new way of life is either temporary, illusory, shallow, or requires a betrayal of self over time. Definitely Miss Ingram, I think, is the catalyst for this. What is Jane's role if Edward marries? Potentially having to go to Ireland is the answer, of course, there. So she realizes that's not what she wants. Number six, initiation and descent to the goddess. The heroine faces a crisis of some sort in which the new way of life is insufficient and the heroine falls into despair. All of the masculine dominant group strategies have failed them. All of the masculine/dominant group strategies have failed them. There's an almost marriage to Mr. Rochester. There's the birth of revelation. She leaves Thornfield and then she's wandering and destitute among the moors. Number seven, heroine urgently yearns to reconnect with the feminine. The heroine wants to, but is unable to return to their initial limited state position. This is definitely recouping at Morehouse, spending time with and becoming close with Diana and Mary Rivers. So connecting with the feminine, becoming a family, gaining family members, finding love. Number eight, heroine heals the mother-daughter split. The heroine reclaims some of their initial values, skills, or attributes, or those of others like them, but now views these traits from a new perspective. Now, this is the one that is out of sequence of the narrative. She's visiting Mrs. Reed on her deathbed. She connects with the Reed daughters to an extent, which is a big change. Number nine, heroine heals the wounded masculine within. The heroine makes peace with the masculine approach to the world as it applies to them, denying St. John and returning to Thornfield. And basically, I think understanding that love is what she seeks. She loves Rochester and she will be with him in a certain capacity, right? I think that if Bertha had not died, I think she would have found some way to be with Rochester, albeit not I don't think in a sexual way, but definitely just like, how can she aid him and still be around him? So she realizes, I think, how much she loves Mr. Rochester. And then finally, number 10, heroine integrates the masculine and feminine. In order to face the world and future with a new understanding of themselves and the world / life, the heroine integrates the masculine and feminine qualities and perspectives. This permits the heroine to see through the binaries and to interact with a complex world that includes the heroine, but is also larger than their personal lifetime or their geographical and cultural milieu. Returning to Rochester, which now is not Thornfield but Ferndean, so symbolic that it's new-ish, marrying Rochester and then also becoming his eyes, his hands, and the mother of his child. So the heroine's journey, she does do it. It follows pretty well. I think even if I tried the hero's journey, right, which I don't really need to, it would fall well. I don't know if Charlotte intentionally did that, but the narrative works great for it. So there we go. So then my final and crucially what we need to talk about point is, how does Jane Eyre work in 2021 looking through this, the modern lens? Okay, so this is, of course, where we can bring in some criticisms here. Is there racism, question mark? Is Bertha not fully white, question mark? That's something that I feel like each time I think about how she's described, and now as I've reached my racial awakening, I really was thinking about this critically. She's a Creole woman. From Jamaica, she's described as having been tall, dark, and majestic. And Creole people are ethnic groups which originated during the colonial era from racial mixing, mainly involving West Africans, as well as some other people born in colonies such as French, Spanish, and indigenous American peoples. And this process is known as Creolization. So no, I don't think that Bertha is white. And so I think the treatment of that is interesting, because the non-white person is also the crazy person. She's she's passionate. She's the demon, right, in the woman in the attic formula. She is treated pretty poorly. Rochester's entrapped to be with her. Things are kept secret. So it's like all these really terrible, different stereotypes, I think, that we generally see over here in American writings of non-white peoples. But definitely some bad portrayals and characteristics of a non-white character. So I think that that is problematic. We also, to throw that on there, of course, she's quote-unquote mad, right? And she's not treated well with her madness. Now, back then, probably the only option was to throw someone in there. But golly, you're locking someone up in the third floor or in an attic. Is that the way to treat them? And did her symptoms or her diagnosis get worse because she was locked up like that with just one caretaker? At least she did have somebody, but she wasn't able to go out or anything. Was she able to clean herself? I don't know. So ableism, I think, through the 2021 lens, as well as racism, all with this one character, which is interesting because the demon character, the bad female character, is also the person of color and insane, which, so that's pretty bad. Then we have the gypsy scene, and I think this is my last, I guess, my criticism here, or the ones that I was thinking about through this 2021 lens. The gypsy scene actually is one of my favorite scenes. I like how it is pulled off, especially in the Timothy Dalton version of, which, if I do that one, I haven't decided yet, but he is way too handsome to be Mr. Rochester. But it's pulled off well, I think, in that. But oh man, I find it fun just because the women all wanted to go down and hang out to look at them as if they, the ladies were considering going to Hay Common just to check out this gypsy camp as if it were, I don't know, like a classic freak show at a circus, or I guess a sideshow would be more like appropriate, or a zoo, something like that. It reminds me almost how the... of Serpents, and now I can't remember, the Hunger Games prequel, how the tributes were treated and they were put in like a monkey cage, I think, so people could watch them and they would throw themselves. Kind of reminds me of that. So basically like a cultural, like, oh, well, let's go do something and look at these people. So clearly the gypsies are treated differently anyways. Definitely Romani or a Romani subgroup known as Romanical, who were prevalent in England at that time. Gypsies weren't treated well, and even recently there have been persecution of them in the UK. So, you know, the play acting is not supposed to be a respectful interpretation. Like, we can't look at it and be like, oh yeah, I mean, it's he's being respectful to them. I mean, the best way I could probably describe it is if Mr. Rochester had put on a blackface show of some sort. Like, that's probably how we should consider it in our terms to make it really come close. So while I enjoy the scene, mainly because he pulls one over the women and tells them he knows so much, this is why I like it. So let me just explain why I like it. And then I, of course, with the understanding that I understand that's problematic. But just even if you take out like the gypsy stuff, what I like about it is that he knows so much about these people that he is able to really pull them in, be believable, and then give them this false or potentially accurate, a glimpse into the future. And so a lot of them he's testing, like especially Ingram, and then the way he and Jane interact is really interesting as well. So I just like how it is choreographed, I guess I'll say, and plotted and scripted. But culturally, it's bad. You've got, yeah, cultural appropriation going on. You do have some cross-dressing because he's not a male gypsy but a female gypsy, which makes sense in terms of there needed to be a comfort there to have the young women be okay being alone with her. But yeah, it's through the 2021 lens, it's pretty problematic, and that's unfortunately what's going to happen sometimes with these novels that don't necessarily age well. So I do think that it's okay that we might appreciate or like something, but understand why it's not appropriate anymore, and also criticize it, which is what I do right there, what I did right there, that I enjoy that scene for certain reasons, and other reasons I recognize that, well, that wasn't actually too respectful, was it? So I think that's it for 2021 lens, and looking back through it, just, yeah, I mean, there's enough, right? I could go through lots of things, but I think that's interesting. The religion is kind of timeless. The criticisms there, I think, can hold up, and we still have, I can think in my mind of particular people that I know that fall into each of those particular categories or archetypes of those. So that certainly is something that doesn't change. You know what? I've talked so long. I think that's all I have to say. I mean, it's not all I have to say about Jane, but I think for this introductory episode and getting your feet wet into Jane and some analysis, but not a lot of analysis, and trying to analyze in a different way, I think I'll say that's it. I'm going to take a break, but when I return, I will be joined by Dr. Renee Lappin, licensed marriage and family therapist, and a clinical fellow with AAMFT. Okay, don't let your carriage ride off too far. I'll be back soon.
Oh, adolescents this generation have no respect and are a far cry from my sweet Jane Eyre and her friend Helen Burns. Why, just this afternoon I was walking
Stella
across, and you know what? Men too. Well,
Stella?
Serious men like the tragic Mr. Rochester and teachers, pa! They're all like the villainous Mr. Brocklehurst.
Hey, Stella!
Yes, Thomas?
As much as I enjoy indulging your insanity, we have a promo to record.
Oh dear, and what might that be?
That is you and I telling everyone that we have a brand new podcast out there. It's called Required Reading with Tom and Stella. Once a month, we will take a look at a single work of literature, discuss it, analyze it, and determine if it's worth its place in the canon.
Oh dear, that sounds delightful.
Oh, I'm sure it will be. And you can find us on the Two True Freaks Network, which is at twotruefreaks.com.
Oh yes, Required Reading with Tom and... Why is it Tom and Stella? Why can't it be Stella and Tom?
It rolls off the tongue better?
Okay.
Well, that was easy. So, Required Reading with Tom and Stella at twotruefreaks.com. Thanks for contributing to the promo there. You did a great job.
Oh, you are so welcome.
Well, welcome back. I am so excited and pleased to introduce my first and probably only guest for this particular podcast. And I do want to start off and just say that she is the mother of one of my closest friends, Joshua Lavin Bertoni. But more specifically, the reason why I'm having her on is that she is a family therapist and psychologist. So this is one of the reasons I really want to get into Mr. Rochester, because it's one of the reasons people don't like this book is because of him. So just to give some background on Dr. Lappin, she earned her bachelor's degree in psychology and master's degree in both school counseling and family counseling at the State University of New York at Buffalo, represent, that's where I grew up, in 1980. She later earned her clinical psychology degree at California Southern University in 2006. Spent 6 years as a family therapist for a residential children's home. She worked as a consultant developing programs and providing direct service to families, adults, adolescents, children, and schools in both New York and Florida. She is a clinical fellow with the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy, and she was awarded the prestigious National Board for Professional Teaching Standards and was granted Florida Supreme Court Subject Matter Specialist for Family Mediation Training Programs. Her publications include a teen monthly advice column, Ask Dr. Renee, in the Parklander magazine, and book School Days and the Divorce Maze, a complete guide for joint custody parents in managing your child's successful school career. She has also established 6 new family therapy programs in elementary, middle, and high school, treating over 3,000 children and families of the Broward County School District. And she's going to be our Mr. Rochester expert for today. So thank you so much, Dr. Lappin, for coming on the show and talking to me.
Hello, Stella. It's very nice to be here. Thank you for that warm-up.
Of course. I made you do some push-ups, I would say, by actually reading through Jane Eyre, so I'm appreciative of your time that you gave us. And I remember in our conversations, you had said you read it probably in AP Lit back in high school, but did you want to expand at all your history with Jane Eyre and maybe any thoughts you have on it, like from a personal rather than professional standpoint?
Well, thank you. From a personal standpoint, I spent a lot of time reading the preface and marveling at how this book was written 147 years ago. And it's hard to believe that so much of what was written is still true today. Mm. I do not remember having read it, although I do know I did read it 50 years ago. But that is because I didn't have the context to understand it as a family therapist. Now that I've spent my entire professional career researching and talking with people and exploring relationships, I have more of a context to understand that. And it seems fascinating to me to know that so much in human relationships and individual strengths and struggles are still present today.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think each time that I read it, as I grow up and, you know, culture and society changes, I start to glean something new and see how it applies to today, or even, you know, looking at this 2021 lens or wherever, how does it maybe not work as much? So that's, yeah, absolutely true.
And I was compelled to do some research to further understand why the author used a male name, mm-hmm, instead of a male name. And Again, it's hard to believe that readers of that generation would choose to believe that that was written by a man. And it was described, besides preserving secrecy and avoiding special treatment by reviewers, she wanted to deter any bias on the base of gender and not being taken seriously. Also, yeah. Difficult to get published. Mm-hmm. So that's still true today to some extent, yeah. Which was very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Upon the description, the detailed description of the inner workings of Jane, her natural desires, her social condition, her thoughts, her feelings, her experiences, it's hard to believe that readers would accept that that was written by a man.
It is true. Yeah, perhaps everyone thought that men were so insightful, and of course they understood the female species. But yeah, looking back at it now, it does seem rather ridiculous that someone has their finger on the pulse of what makes a woman and just her internal thoughts and feelings.
Now, currently, there might be some men who would be able to write that, but in that period of time, I don't believe there were.
Yeah, I agree. Well, we did kind of go back and forth. I know that you were reading it, but I also, as I was reading it, I had this document up that I called the Rochester Tracker, where I looked through whenever a particular passage came up that maybe described him in particular or his interactions with Jane or things that might have been alarming. I wrote them down, and that was something certainly that I sent to you just in case you want to focus on those particular passages. But just considering some of those passages that I highlighted, and then even upon your reading, how would you describe, you know, as a doctor, if Edward Fairfax Rochester were your patient, or if you were describing him in a doctorly way, how would you describe him?
Well, I would say that he is hurting. This is a man that struggles. He doesn't seem to have an inner strength. He doesn't seem to have a sense of self-confidence, and he doesn't seem to have a self-esteem, a positive self-esteem. He doesn't have appropriate social skills. He doesn't have any sense of spirituality or faith, lacks creativity, and he just wants to be loved. He's looking for love, doesn't know how to find it, and at the very end, we see that he does perform in a very heroic way, where he showed bravery. But there's not much positive going on for him there. Mm-hmm. He was abandoned by his father and his brother at an early age, and that seems to have had a big effect on his development.
The big question I think that I wanted to get at, which seems odd that I'm going to drop it as soon as possible, but it's the abusive or toxic relationship that he may have with Jane, or at least people that criticize the novel really lean into. And there are more specific questions, of course, that I have about him and really getting into his being. But just to like address this right off the bat, how would you describe his relationship with Jane? And would you consider it toxic or abusive?
Well, contrary to the way Edward developed, Jane was also betrayed and had lost early on in her life. And in the first several chapters, the description of her experiences would easily describe a current victim of domestic violence. We wonder why somebody stays currently when there's abuse continually. And the description is so well documented in the early chapters, yet we find that she overcomes that and grows up to have confidence and have strength and not being a victim, contrary to Edward. So I would say that there was one scene in the book, one description, where he really did not want her to leave and she was going to leave, and he said, I will make you stay. I'll physically make you stay.
Yeah.
Which was an abusive statement to make. However, I did not see an abusive relationship between Jane and Edward. As a matter of fact, throughout the book, She really had it over him. She had a sense of purpose, a sense of confidence. She had self-esteem. She had a sense of spirituality and faith. She had very appropriate social skills and a lot of relationships that were positive with people, unlike him. She had a unique sense of creativity when she needed to resolve problems, and an inner strength that just kept growing stronger and stronger. While Rochester, Mr. Rochester, did not have that. And so when you compare the two of them, I don't feel that it was an abusive relationship. As far as it being a toxic relationship, I don't think it was a toxic relationship for Jane. Other than her intense longings to be with him, I did not feel that she suffered any negative effects in terms of the relationship that she and Edward had. She was lit up by her love for him and knowing that love does exist. Early on in the book, she said that people need to be loved, and that pretty much states what her purpose was. Mm. And she loved him, and that benefited her, whether they were together or not. That fueled her, and that gave her a sense of hope and purpose, and it aligned with her moral compass as to why we are on this earth.
Yeah. There are two scenes in particular that I roll my eyes at when I'm reading them and also think poorly of Edward. And one of them is when Jane is forced to come into the party when all those people are at the house. And they know she's there and they're talking very boldly and negatively about governesses, and he does nothing to defend her or anything. And the other scene is the pre-proposal scene where he leads her into thinking that she's going to have to go to Ireland because he's going to be marrying Miss Ingram. And then in the end, it turns around really quickly. He's like, what are you talking about? I'm not marrying Miss Ingram. I want to marry you. So it's almost as if he does say that he wanted to make her jealous and test her feelings and everything. But do you have any thoughts on those particular scenes?
Yes, I can talk about those scenes. Let me talk first about the first one where she was in the room and they were talking about governesses. They were trashing governesses, yeah. And he did nothing to defend her. I don't think he knew how to be gallant. Hmm. I don't think he would have been aware that this was hurtful. At that time, as is the same true today, we ignore the people that serve us. We might stop our conversation briefly if a waiter or waitress comes to the table, but we don't recognize and cherish and honor the people that provide service to us, and we don't show an awareness of how important they are. So I think that is still true today, and it takes a very insightful person to be aware that these service people have feelings, and things that we say or do without recognizing their presence can be very hurtful. I think that really just is similar to the way things are today. As far as him being gallant, I don't think he knows how to. He was never taught to. It doesn't sound like that was ever addressed in his upbringing. In the second scene that you talked about, again, this proposal, that was very interesting. Throughout Edward's relationship with Jane, he recognized that he did not have the self-confidence that she had. And very early on, he asked her if she had a respect for him. And they don't use the word respect. They use right to command. Mm. And that really is my favorite passage in the whole book. And she said, I don't think, sire, that you have a right to command me merely because you are older than I or because you have seen more of the world than I have. Your claim to superiority depends on the use you have made of your time and your expertise. And if you replace the word command with respect or allegiance, she was saying that you don't earn my respect if you don't do good in this world. And he knew that he was not doing right in the world. He talked about looking for love and eventually trying to find prostitutes. he talked, or he didn't tell her about his wife and how he was managing that situation. So it doesn't sound like he felt he was doing good in the world, and therefore he knew that he didn't have her respect, didn't have his own self-respect and confidence. And in today's world as well, often when people are getting to know each other, they misrepresent themselves. Think about dating sites. Eventually, they figure after the person has fallen in love with them, they will reveal their true self. But they might lie about their age or their occupation. So I think what Mr. Rochester did was he did not have confidence in what he had to offer to Jane, other than the fact that he had a higher class and he had money. And so he pretended to be someone he wasn't. He also didn't have social skills. He couldn't come right out and say, I like you. I would like to get to know you better. I enjoy just having you around. He didn't have the social skills to know how to do that. But he could say, I command that you sit in the parlor each night. Even when he was having conversations with her, he was always trying to pull a scam of some sort.
Yeah.
For example, when he pretended to be the fortune teller, he just wanted to talk with her, spend time with her, get to know her. And he pulled this elaborate scam to do that. And the same with the wedding proposal. Rather than say, I love you and I want to spend the rest of my life with you, he went all about in different confusing circles to get to that point, because he just couldn't come right out and say it. He didn't have the confidence and the strength of his conviction. So, yes, with that weird pre-wedding proposal, I thought it was just a result of his lack of social skills and lack of confidence that he felt the need to go around in circles in that way.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the word scam, and you also mentioned online dating and waiting to reveal your true self. And that makes me think about the fact that he tells Jane that a year and one day after their wedding, he will reveal all to her, which is a bit... It's a bit alarming, and I have to think about Tessa the D'Urbervilles as well. Shout out to Professor Allen. But do you feel like Edward is at all entrapping Jane in promising, well, in not revealing everything before the marriage happened?
Well, he might be trying to entrap her, but it didn't work.
No.
She would not have married him had she known that, and I'm not sure if there is something legally that was going on in that era regarding a marriage needing to be more than a year and a day. I don't think that is a random number. If it's not a legal number, he might have felt that that's how long it would take her to truly fall in love with him so much that nothing else would matter.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'd have to look that up to see. I don't know if maybe it's past the point of annulment, or so she's like really in it. I don't know. Yeah, I'd have to look that up.
Had she married him and found out about his wife, she would not have stayed with him in her heart. She might have stayed with him under the same roof, but she would not have been there in spirit.
Yeah, I agree. Something that's seems to have caught on more, and I think it's mostly because of pop culture, and I'm thinking in particular of certain musicians like Billie Eilish or Olivia Rodrigo, dating older gentlemen, or even perhaps gentlemen that are maybe producers or someone in their line of business that might have some hierarchy above them, is grooming. Grooming seems to be a big term that whenever someone sees someone younger dating someone older, the term grooming is thrown out there right away. Do you feel like there's any grooming potential here, or do you get a sense of that maybe just because Jane is 18? I mean, by the end of the novel, she might be 19, but Edward is 20 years older than her, and it's not too strange in that particular time, but even some people in the household think it's a little odd, like Mrs. Fairfax, for instance. Do you feel, I mean, if you encountered a couple like this, would that at all be, I keep saying the word alarming, but that's the only one that's coming up to me, would you your hackles be up or would you be concerned at all?
Well, right now, 18 is different than 18 was back then.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that it did not do a disservice to Jane in any way. If you look at her development, she went on throughout her life to become stronger in everything, in her sense of confidence, in her ability to interact with the world, in her spirituality, her inner compass that she was following, her creativity, her relationships, her values. So when we look at age difference, we think of it as being a problem if it somehow takes away from the younger person. And I think of the word grooming for children. I don't think she was a child.
Mm-hmm.
And if you didn't look at their chronological age, she was far older than him in her ability to navigate the world. So the age difference did not disturb me.
Okay. I would agree that they are more equal, or she is more superior than him, than you would look at just like data from their characters potentially. So something that I thought, especially during, I think, the proposal scene, is Edward just seems to be in a bit of a pit of despair. His soul seems a bit black just with the things that have happened to him with his past and his history. He doesn't seem to find anyone that loves him for him, as you've mentioned before. Is this a good reason to potentially seek someone out, or is feelings for Jane legitimate, or does he look to Jane to potentially save him and be that light that his current, you know, to light up the darkness of his life that he's currently living?
Well, clearly, when he met Jane, he felt a light bulb go off, and he did feel that her love would light up his life. Mm-hmm. I think he was confused about that feeling because he hadn't seen that before. It probably was the first time that he felt that he was in love. She too, Jane as well, felt an intense feeling of love towards Mr. Rochester, towards Edward. And she said early on that we're put on this earth to love each other.
Mm.
So I don't know that I would equate loving someone as saving them. I think loving them means that you see them for everything that they are and you bring out the best in them.
Mm. And would you say that happens on Jane's side as well? Is Edward able to bring out the best in Jane?
Jane loves Edward so much that being with him makes her feel secure. She was confident without him, and she was able to use a lot of creativity to navigate her circumstances and the world. She had a lot of self-reliance. She was very self-assured. But when she is with Edward, she feels content. She feels at home. If anything, this book gives us hope in the fact that romantic love does exist.
Mm.
Both of them describe how they feel towards each other and how it makes them feel about themselves. And for both of them, it's a positive thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mentioned Edward entrapping Jane, and you said, perhaps not. But was Edward himself entrapped, or should he own his part and in the wooing and marriage to Bertha?
Mm-hmm. Well, that is a very interesting situation about how he managed Bertha.
Yeah.
We learn that he was betrayed and tricked by his father and his brother into marrying her.
Mm-hmm.
Given the mental health services available 147 years ago, there were not a lot of options of what you can do with somebody that had Bertha's condition.
Mm-hmm.
She was not only mentally ill, but she was a danger to herself and a danger to others, as we see throughout the book, more than once. So what can be done to care for a person? Very, very similarly today, we don't have a lot of options of how to care for somebody that has a mental illness and is a danger to themselves and others. So currently, there's not a lot of options for us to care for mentally ill people who are a danger to themselves and others. And there were much, much fewer options in that time frame. I feel that if Jane had been presented with a similar situation, she would find a creative way to manage that. Whereas Edward did not have creativity. I don't think that he meant to be hurtful. I don't think that he was a bad person. I think he lacked options and he lacked creativity. And he so desperately wanted love that he would do anything to seek out love, which just was not going to be an option if he made his marriage to Bertha known.
Hmm. Do you think him putting Bertha in the attic exacerbated her sickness at all?
Well, it's hard to know what her life was like in the attic. She did have somebody caring for her 24/7, except for when that caretaker would get drunk or fall asleep.
Yeah.
So the fact that Edward had enough funds to hire someone to care for her, she was fed. Obviously, it didn't sound like she had any sunshine or exercise or the other types of treatments that we have today that we know are helpful. Had she had an ability to go out for walks and have water exercise and all different types of music therapy and yoga, I don't know that her condition would have been any better. Those are just soothing types of treatments. They don't provide a cure. Probably she would have been medicated very, very much with that type of illness today. And I don't think that medication was available at that time.
No, she probably just, I mean, if she's not locked up in the attic, I just have a sense that they would have thrown her somewhere else. So at least he brought her with him. But I do know that that's a criticism against his character, the fact that he does just throw her up there and try to forget about her and tell everyone else that she doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm. Again, he lacked creativity. He couldn't come up with another solution. Whereas I feel that Jane would have been able to figure out a much more creative solution to manage.
Hmm. To what extent do you think we should show him empathy or even potentially condemn him for what he does with Bertha? And then even maybe later with Jane trying to get her to stay with him outside of marriage once she finds out about Bertha.
Well, it's interesting that you ask if we should show him empathy or condemn him. Readers enjoy reading about characters, but when I read about a character, I don't pass judgment.
Mm.
I notice what they're feeling, even with people that are real people, not fictional people. If I'm reading nonfiction, the joy of reading is to understand the characters and to learn more about them. And I don't look at condemning or seeing if a person is entitled to empathy when I'm reading about a character. I just look to notice what they're feeling without judgment.
Okay.
Notice what their experience is and be aware of their experience. But if I had to pick, I would say certainly he has is deserving of both empathy and condemnation.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, I guess I... That's where you and I differ a bit, just because I always am analyzing those characters, and if they're, you know, doing things I don't necessarily agree and I agree with, I try to figure out, well, why are they doing this and how can I best understand them? But I totally get what you're saying as well.
And I think it might be my training that therapists are non-judgmental.
Mm.
So right. I guess I treat fictional characters with that same non-judgment as I do with clients and I try to do with people in my life.
Yeah, bleed through every facet of your life. Okay, well, something I discovered in my research for setting this episode up and this podcast up as well is that some literary critics believe that his wounds at the end are a sign of figurative castration, which I thought was a bit extreme. But I'm going to ask you, does this seem like a legitimate read? Is it a bit extreme? And then do his wounds and loss of Thornfield, loss of that estate, at least foster, I think, more surface-level equality between him and Jane, that now they're literally equals?
Well, there's a couple of questions in there. As far as his wounds being a sign of castration, I did not look at it that way, but I I think that's the, you know, that's the beauty of having so many different people reading a novel. People see things differently. What I saw that his wounds were representing was a medal of honor of his. Finally, he shows bravery. He saves his staff, and he even tries to save Bertha. And he doesn't think of himself. He's not selfish. Whereas throughout the book, he doesn't show any selfless acts. So I see those wounds as a true medal of the bravery that he showed.
Just as a follow-up, do you feel like in that moment he really develops and comes into his own as a character, and that the rest of the novel he might be pretty static?
We don't really hear what he's thinking at that time. We hear third-hand reports of what he did. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to know. It would be interesting if we were able to hear from him what was going on in his mind during that time. So it's hard to say. Mm-hmm. I don't think he was static or shallow. I think it was a foil to show the difference between two people, Jane and Edward, having brought up with losses and betrayals and traumas. One of them growing up to become a survivor, and the other one growing up to be damaged. Jane didn't suffer a lack of self-confidence or self-assuredness or self-reliance. She had appreciation, she had gratitude, she had creativity, whereas Edward had none of that. So I think that the description of him was highlighting the description of Jane to be a survivor and to show all of her strengths.
And then thoughts on that second part about, are they now equals spiritually and economically and physically?
Well, it's interesting because even today, people that don't have the same amount of money that get together as a couple often do not feel like equals because money equals power. Hmm. So perhaps they were equals financially in both. They might have both had the same amount of money, but I don't think that they were equals in terms of self-assuredness and self-confidence. From beginning to end, Jane had much more of that than he did.
Hmm. Yeah. Okay, well, I would be remiss if I did not mention the other, and I hesitate to say it, the other potential love interest in Mr. St. John Rivers. And I don't care for him very much. He just seems so extreme in everything he does. Very legalistic, I would say. But given the choice, I'm kind of putting you on the spot here, like choose A or B, which I know is rough. But given the choice between Rochester and St. John, do you feel like there is a healthier choice, and which of those two might be the healthier choice? And because I kind of skipped a lot, if you wanted to talk about St. John and how you might describe him as a character or anything you may have seen reading those passages, please feel free to.
Right. Well, that's interesting. Jane, as I said, mentions very early on that we're put on this earth to love each other. And so you know what her personal compass is, and that is about love. And she loved Rochester, so choosing him would be consistent with her values and her beliefs as to why she's on this earth. St. John Rivers made it very clear that he was in love with the church and his mission, and there was no way, no how, that he was ever going to love her romantically. So if we want to be consistent with what Jane sees as her personal compass, clearly Rochester would be the healthier choice, in that she would be remaining true to her own values. She sees love equal to marriage. The marriage proposal that she was offered by St. John Rivers was not a marriage proposal with love. So it would be consistent with her values.
Yeah, I think the quote from him is, you know, enough of love will follow. And that's when Jane, I think, realizes, I got to get out of here. Is it a potential choice that Jane remain alone? Would that be something that you would offer as a choice?
Well, actually, she did remain alone. She left Edward and followed a life where she was very much alone. She had that opportunity, and I think that it was a wonderful opportunity for her to have both being alone and being with a husband that she loved. I don't think she missed out on that option.
That is true. She wanders through the moors. Yeah, absolutely. Those were the main questions that I wanted to highlight when talking to you. But I do want to give you the floor if there is anything else that you feel like that really popped out at you, or anything you wanted to talk about, whether it's the whole novel, Jane or Edward or any other character.
There are a couple of notes that I made that I thought were very interesting.
Please.
Yes, in the preface, there is, in the second edition, the author says, it remains true that appearances should not be mistaken for truth. And I think that that is a theme that we see throughout. Edward had the class status, he had the money, yet he really did not have her love and admiration, Jane's love or admiration, because he wasn't worthy of that. There's another thread which I'm surprised that you didn't mention. It's that about physical beauty.
Oh, true. Yeah, I could have brought that up.
Yes. There's a number of mentions. Early on, she doesn't feel she's lovable because she's physically unattractive. And there's a lot mentioning about whether Edward is attractive or whether he isn't attractive, whether he's ugly. And at some point, they are talking about his personality, what's inside. But a lot of the time, they're talking about his physical features. And there's a thread of women liking kind of frilly and girly type things. The young girl that Jane is watching was just so thrilled to have a dress.
Yeah.
And Edward knew that she would be. there's a lot of detailed description about how physically attractive St. John Rivers is.
Mm-hmm.
And then also his love interest, how physically attractive that woman is as well. So there's a comparison between physical beauty and not being beautiful, and whether that is something that is worthy of having the finer things in life. And towards the end, they refer to that as physiognomy. And I looked that up. It's the art of judging character from facial characteristics. So there's a lot said about that, and that physical beauty is still a thread that we have currently as well.
Absolutely.
So that initial quote that I mentioned about appearance should not be mistaken for truth, there's a lot of allusion to superiority with physical beauty. Jane was not interested in being pampered. She didn't want dresses. The scene where he wants to buy her dresses, she's just so upset about that, and she doesn't want that. And I think that still describes a lot of people today. Some people are very enamored with physical beauty, and some people think that it really has no meaning, and it doesn't impair the way they see themselves. So I thought that was an interesting thread.
Absolutely. Yeah. I, one of the most poignant scenes, I think, in the novel regarding that is when she paints or draws two portraits. One is of herself, and the other one is her imaginings of what Miss Ingram looks like, just from a description I think that maybe Mrs. Fairfax had given her. And just like this, oh, it's almost hard to read, just like the description and how sad and forlorn I think she gets, that, you know, this could be the potential love interest for Mr. Rochester, and look, I am just this, you know, plain Jane. Yeah, so totally. Yeah, I guess the reason maybe I didn't bring it up is because it's one of the reasons why I love Jane, and she's my favorite literary heroine tied with Scarlett O'Hara, but is because I feel like she's an every woman. It's someone that I could certainly identify with. She's not this bombshell that, you know, it's not like a wish fulfillment, but someone I could actually like envision being. And so I always appreciated that about her. But you're absolutely true that beauty and that's, or lack thereof, is focused on a great deal in this novel.
And is today as well. There's not much difference.
Mm-hmm. It's very true. Yep.
So the initial comment about appearances should not be mistaken for truth. And then later on, Jane is, at the end of the book, there is no longer illusions. Clearly, Jane is on top. She has it all. She has the self-confidence and the self-esteem. She has her sexuality. She has her love. And she's very content.
Mm-hmm. She just had to go through one heck of a journey to get there.
And I can see why you like her very much as a character.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I think, besides her every woman nature, I think also just the fact that she stands up to Mr. Rochester constantly when he gives her gruff, and she can be just as sarcastic or straightforward and blunt as he is. So she doesn't take it.
And she did that as a child as well to her aunt.
Yep. Yeah, she survived so much. She is a survivor for sure.
Wonderful character.
Absolutely. Well, any other thoughts that you may have on the work?
Again, it's just pretty amazing that 174 years ago, not much has changed in the way people interact with the world and the way people view beauty and class distinction.
Yeah. Some works are truly timeless. I think that this one is one of those works. There are some scenes that are a bit troubling now, looking through the 2021 lens, or the modern lens, I should just say. But overall, yeah, I think a lot of the themes really hold true.
Well, Jane certainly shows a woman who develops into resilience.
Absolutely.
I think that is the allure, because people that might be reading it might be thinking of their own struggles and what they did as a result of those struggles. Jane shows resilience, and she is not only surviving, but she's thriving.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, it's been such a pleasure to hear your insight into all of these characters and to chat about their romantic relationship and their difficult pasts. And number one, just a pleasure to be able to talk to Josh's mom. Yeah, this is going to go down as a historical moment in my life, Dr. Lappin.
Oh, please call me Renee. And It was a pleasure to have the opportunity. I appreciate you inviting me to do this, and I needed to read the book in order to talk about it, and I'm glad that I did.
Yeah, thank you so much for that time that you took to do that. I do like to promote other people, and whether it's professional or podcasting, and I know you're on the professional side, but is there any way that we can support you, or where can listeners find you?
Well, if a listener would like to learn more about me and my practice, my website is www.askdrrenee.com. That is askdrrenee.com. .net will also take you there. And you can learn more about me and my practice. You can also find some more personal information, some travel photos, if you'd like some inspiration, on my Facebook site for Ask Dr. Renee. Again, it's askdrrenae.
Lovely.
It's been my honor and my pleasure to talk with you and to appear as a guest for your podcast. Thank you, Stella.
And thank you. Yeah, the same for me as well.
If you'd like to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, Jane demands it, go to our Patreon page at patreon.com/fwpodcasts, where you can make a one-time or monthly contribution and unlock various rewards, including getting name-checked on this or any network show of your choice. And perhaps even I, Jane, will bestow upon you the honor of being called Mr. Rochester. Support the network and harvest the good fruits. Be sure to subscribe to the show wherever podcasts can be found. Send questions or comments to batgirltooracle@gmail.com, don't question it, and follow @batgirltooracle on Twitter. Thank you, dear listeners, for lending your ears to this show. And until next time, pray do read a book.
I will never lose faith. I will never lose heart. For you have restored my trust.
And I know you're afraid. I'm as scared as you are. but willing it will be brave.
Brave, brave, I will never lose heart, for you have restored my trust, and I know you're afraid. I'm as scared as you are, but willing to be brave. I will never lose faith, I will never lose heart, for you have restored my trust, and I can.
Enough.